A warm greeting to our dear listeners wherever you may be listening from. This is Iran Radio from the heart of Iran's vibrant capital, Tehran. Straightly, we go to the interesting facts about Islam. During the Golden Age of Islam, Muslims created a house of wisdom, or Baytul Hikmah, which was active during the 9th and 13th century, where both Muslims and non-Muslims scholars sought to translate the world's knowledge into Arabic. Many classic works of antiquity that might have otherwise been lost were preserved in Arabic and Persian and later translated into Turkish, Hebrew, and Latin. Here, scholars synthesized and significantly advanced knowledge gained from the Persian, Roman, Chinese, Egyptian, Greek, Byzantine, and Phoenician civilizations. Muslim scholars like Ibn Rushd and Avicenna were primarily responsible for saving the works of prominent Greek philosopher Aristotle. For this hour, we have Spotlight. Then we have Bridge, connecting you to sacred supplications. This program presents a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications from the Noble Book of Sahifa As-Sajjadiyya. Sahifa As-Sajjadiyya is a collection of 54 supplications and prayers dedicated by Imam Sajjad, Shia's fourth Imam, peace be upon him. Then we have another segment of radio productions. Up next is a Spotlight. Stay tuned.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The UN Security Council has rejected a bid to keep sanctions relief for Iran, paving the way for renewed UN sanctions within days. Iran has slammed the move, calling any attempt by the European trio to reimpose sanctions baseless and a direct assault on international law. Iran's ambassador to the UN, Amir Saidi Ravani, emphasized that in a striking display of hypocrisy, the European trio and the U.S. claim that Tehran must be punished for the reciprocal measures it took years after enduring violations by the other side. The three European countries triggered the snapback process last month, accusing Iran of breaching its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. That mechanism will expire on October the 18th. And if no deal is reached by September 28th, international sanctions suspended under the nuclear deal will automatically return. Allow me to introduce my guests for tonight's show. Security and political analyst Ali Rizk, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And we also have independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Dottrow, joining us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Rizk in Beirut. Iran's ambassador to the UN, Amir Saidi Ravani, said today's action was hasty, unnecessary, and unlawful. The Iranian foreign minister also highlighted that the push to revive sanctions lacked consensus and faced serious opposition from several council members. What were your expectations for today's session, Mr. Rizk?
I think that the expectations were that indeed that this measure wouldn't pass and that the sanctions are going to be implemented or imposed. In fact, the French President Emmanuel Macron said as much during an interview with Israeli television when he was asked about this topic. He was asked, are you certain, I think, that the sanctions are going to be imposed? He responded in the affirmative. So I don't think it comes as a big surprise. And I think that a lot of it's related to European animosity towards Iran, specifically over Russia. In other words, there's a lot of hostility and animosity between the Europeans and the Russians over Ukraine. And we know that Iran has drawn closer to Russia in recent years. And so that's made Iran more of an enemy in Europe's eyes. I think that is one or possibly the major factor, not the only one, but a major factor behind the European approach to Iran and the fact that they've decided to impose these sanctions.
Gilbert Doctorow, Iran's ambassador to the UN, said any attempt by the European trio to reimpose sanctions is baseless and a direct assault on international law and the Council's credibility. Give us your perspective on this route that the E3 decided to pursue ultimately.
I believe that the underlying reasons for this action have nothing to do with Iran. I agree with the remarks of my fellow panelists that they are to be understood in reference to Europe's positions on Russia. And this action against Iran is in its own way similar to Donald Trump's attacks on boats in the Caribbean, allegedly coming from Venezuela and carrying narcotics. This is the action of a bully, a cowardly bully, who looks for a weak spot to flex his muscles and show his strength. And that is what the European Troika is doing. They are picking on Iran because they don't have the guts to go directly after Russia. That's what it's all about.
All right, I risk China and Russia, who backed today's proposal. They condemned further sanctions on Tehran as counterproductive, illegal, and invalid. They also released a joint statement regarding the anti-Iran sanctions. The two countries said that the reinstatement of the sanctions were illegal. They will not comply with or abide by these renewed sanctions. So break down the response from China and Russia. And what message do you think this sends to the other side, to those who are pushing for the renewal of the sanctions and for cranking up pressure on Iran?
Well, I think it was very clear during the recent summits which were held in Beijing, if you remember, Chinese President Xi Jinping hosting a number of world leaders, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, also Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian, and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. I think that this by the way, another very important development during that summit, perhaps the most important, was the participation of the Indian Prime Minister Modi. I think that was a major, major development. So I think that that particular summit showed that there's an emerging bloc which is taking shape. And the reason why I focused on India is that India is traditionally seen to be on the Western or in the Western camp. But what happened in Beijing, I think, proved that something different is taking shape because, I think, of Trump's own policies. And I also believe that this also brings me to another important issue. For example, India didn't commit to the sanctions which were imposed on Russia. That's why Trump chose to increase the tariffs. But that just goes to tell you that even if the Western camp does intend to increase the maximum pressure on Iran, a lot of the countries aren't going to commit to that, regardless of this resolution or regardless of the European intentions to reactivate the snapback mechanism. So China and Russia, yes, they won't commit to it, but I think also countries like India, it's quite possible that they might not also commit to it. So this era of Western hegemony and the West being able to impose its own will, I think that slowly is breaking down. And I think Trump's policies, by the way, are speeding up the process of it breaking down. So yes, it is considered to be, I think, an escalatory step. But I think that other countries do have their own incentives to try and stop or limit the how effective these measures will be, not just for the sake of Iran, I think, but also because they want to prove their own points that there's a new world order which is emerging and that the U.S. can no longer use these sanctions in such a way.
And Mr. Doctorow, about the reactions and responses coming in following the U.N. Security Council session, if you'd like to add anything to China and Russia's response. Also, Pakistan said invoking snapback complicates the situation. Iran's cooperation with the IAEA could be an area which gets complicated.
I subscribe completely to the remarks of my fellow panelists with respect to the positions of China and Russia on the snapback. Let's remember that going back 10 years, the Russians and other countries that have been subjected to sanctions went along with the diktat of coming from the United States and its allies to impose sanctions on country X, Y, and Z. That game is over. And it has been declared invalid from the highest possible point. That is Russia and China. And for that reason, the notion that hegemony is unraveling, or has unraveled already, and cannot be put back in place, is a very important development to which we are witnesses. Having said that, of course I appreciate that imposing or reimposing sanctions on Iran will be very painful for your country. And I am hopeful that understanding in places like Russia and China will enable mitigation of the pain that the Troika in Europe intend to impose. Let us also consider that they are acting in the hope, one more action, in the hope of currying favor with Donald Trump. Trump, of course, is much tougher on Iran than he dares to be on Russia. So this is a situation in which Iran is an unwilling victim, and an innocent victim, one can say. It is being punished for the simple reason that those who are imposing these sanctions believe that they can do to Iran what they cannot do to a country like Russia. And,
okay.
That is sad.
So, Mr. Risk, Gilbert Doctorow believes that the trail leads back to Russia. Iran's foreign minister, however, he has accused the European Troika, France, Germany, and the UK of colluding with Israel and the United States to maliciously pressure the Iranian people. Your reaction to that accusation, and do you agree with the Iranian foreign minister?
I think that part of it's about the United States, but again, I think the Europeans have their own hostility towards Iran, which is separate than the issue of the United States. And it wouldn't be the first time, by the way. If you go back to when Obama wanted to reach the agreement, or when he did reach the agreement with Iran, France objected strongly initially. It was the most hawkish player out of all of the P5 plus one. And at the initial phase, it obstructed the American efforts, Obama's efforts to reach an agreement. This time round, I think that the European stance is even more hawkish, as I said, due to the developments that have taken place between Iran and Russia. By that, I mean the closer ties between the two countries. But regarding Israel, I think that's an interesting point. And this brings me to the issue of the European intentions to recognize a Palestinian state. And we hear now about potential European sanctions against Israel. Now, I think possibly, the Europeans, in order to satisfy the Israelis, they might be following the strategy in such a way, in the following way, that we recognize a Palestinian state, we might sanction some Israeli right-wing figures, but at the same time, we impose sanctions against Iran. That way, they might make up for Israel. So they take some anti-Israeli measures on the one hand, but they make up for that by escalating against Iran. And I think many Western countries do pursue these kinds of policies in order to gain the satisfaction of Israel, because Israel still, I think, wields enormous influence over political decision-making in the West.
Gilbert Doctorow, along the lines of the same issue, a guest that we spoke to earlier here following today's UN Security Council session said that there is a constant effort to undermine Iran at every turn. Please tell us whether you agree with that or not, and who benefits from this?
Well, the beneficiary, of course, is Israel. Any restrictions on Iran that cause economic power, any restrictions that cause a weakening of some sort in the military capabilities of Iran, all serve the purposes of Israel. As regards Israeli influence on this decision, I'm rather skeptical. The decision to reimpose or use a snapback, I'm rather skeptical that they played any significant role. I still say the issues are more on the United States, currying favor with the United States, and doing to Iran what they would like to do to Russia, but don't have the ability or the force of will to do.
Sure. And Ali Riz, just chronologically looking at everything that led up to the situation we are right now, the E3, they also severely failed in carrying out their obligations under the JCPOA. So what about all of Europe's shortcomings in the implementation of the nuclear deal? And why did Iran have to do all the heavy lifting all these years? Why has Iran always been the one to shoulder the responsibility of keeping the JCPOA afloat?
Well, I think that's been the issue all along. I have to emphasize here, I must slightly disagree with my colleague. I still think Israel wields enormous influence over the West, and I think this goes a long way in giving an answer to what you just asked.
Absolutely.
Israel is viewed as a natural ally of the West, of Europe, and of the United States. And as a result of Israel being viewed as this natural ally, that leads to these double standards which you just referred to. The Europeans weren't able to live up to their own pledges of the deal simply because Trump introduced this mechanism of secondary sanctions, meaning that if the EU were to continue with business deals with Iran after the US withdrew under Trump, they would be subject to sanctions, and I think the EU economies are just too weak to withstand that. But again, I think the basic point is that Israel continues to be viewed, despite everything which is happening and the horrors of Gaza, it's still viewed as a natural Western ally, and that's translated into these policies which appear to be illogical and place all of the onus on Iran without looking at how other parties have not lived up to their commitments or pledges.
Mr. Doctor, would you like to respond to that?
Well, if we look at this old question of the smaller devil and the bigger devil, the smaller devil being Israel and the bigger devil being the United States, I put my money on the bigger devil. This is what we are now engaged in, my fellow panelists and myself, is a debate over whether Israel is the tail wagging the dog, or whether the head is wagging the tail. I opt for the head wagging the tail. Israel does what the United States wants, and it's not because Israel dominates the United States, but because the United States dominates or can dominate Israel if and when, at any moment, it wants to. Everyone knows full well that the moment that the United States pulls the plug on its economic support to Israel, Israel will fold. So the situation is a bit different to my perspective from the presentation that Israel is calling the shots and the United States falls into line.
All right, and staying with you, Mr. Doctor, Iran has been calling out a serious double standard here where Tehran has demonstrated its peaceful intentions, pointing to years of cooperation with the IAEA and the transparency it has shown under the NPT. But Israel, which is carrying out a genocide as we speak, it possesses nuclear weapons without scrutiny, and Iran here is being punished for its civilian nuclear technology.
Well, unfortunately, the world we're living in has more than double standards to worry about. It is very sad that the Gulf states have done nothing to save the Palestinians and to put pressure, military pressure, and as well as political pressure, on Israel to desist. That is the world we live in. It's a much more complicated world than we have been discussing till now, and it is regrettable that none of the great powers can move in. It's logical they can't move in if the neighbors of Israel and Palestine are doing nothing other than Iran. Iran is very active, the Houthis are very active, but the rest of the region is quiet.
And same question to you, Mr. Risk, about this double standard and hypocrisy that we're seeing with regards to the Israeli regime.
If you just give me a minute to respond to that point, I know we're going off script here, but I have to emphasize that the recent strike on Doha, Qatar, the Israeli attack, I think that proves, in my humble opinion, beyond any doubt, that it's Israel which directs U.S. policy in the way it wishes more than the other way around. I'm not saying it dominates or it always decides, but it does have significant influence. Look at the pro-Israeli lobby. Look at the evangelicals, and the U.S., it can, if it pulls the plug on economic aid to Israel, yes, Israel wouldn't survive. But I don't think that there's any U.S. president who has the political will to do so because of the dangers that would expose. The strike on Qatar, you're talking about CENTCOM, the base of CENTCOM. Now, how that strike serves American interests, I fail to see. Regarding the double standards, look, again, this is standard Western policy. There are certain players which are signified as national allies, signified, and that's the way the policies are pursued, despite the fact that this sometimes is contradictory to Western interests, but they continue to pursue that, and it seems to want to be rather illogical, not based on any strategic or rational calculations.
Gilbert Doctorow, let's talk about the credibility of the United Nations Security Council in its entirety as well. Do you think that the Security Council is a body for peace, or is it the exact opposite? Because we have to also allude to the constant resolutions for a ceasefire in Gaza that have been vetoed at the Security Council.
There's no question but that the UN Security Council is not functioning as designed. But there, it was always, from the very beginning, intended to be a place of dispute and failure to resolve issues. That was foreseen when the veto was given to the permanent members. So I don't see a very great deterioration in the efficacy of UN resolutions or in the actions of the Security Council itself. That the Security Council is a talking buddy, and it is a place where some debates of importance take place, which can be useful for informing the broad public across the world. However, when matters are critical, as they are in the Palestinian issue, on the issue of Iran today, we can expect that the various interests work against any effective resolution. And that's where we are today.
Okay,
so the issue is in the region, and the region is doing nothing.
Okay, final question to Mr. Risk. Same issue about the United Nations Security Council. Do you think there's a big question mark over the credibility of the likes of the UNSC? Is it a force for good, or is it a force to stifle good?
I'm not sure if we can say it's a force for good or a force for evil. The UN Security Council, it's a result of World War II, basically, whereby you have the most powerful countries that emerge after World War II, which have veto power. Each country, yesterday, for example, it turned out to be a force of sheer evil when the U.S. used that veto against the resolution regarding genocide, which is
right,
taking place in Gaza. So there are certain powers who exercise their own their own domination, if you would like, in order to push through their own policies. And I think that more and more we're approaching the law of the jungle, if you would like, outside the framework of the UN. One very good example of that is not only the genocide in Gaza, but also what the guests referred to, the current US campaign against Venezuela, the attack on boats and fishermen, which is happening. Also how the George Bush administration launched the war on terror without going back to the Security Council. So I think for quite some time, the UN Security Council can or has been only able to do so much.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. Security and political analyst Ali Rizk joining us from Beirut, and independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow joining us from Brussels. Thank you, gentlemen, and a special thanks to our viewers for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdu wa thana' lillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salam ala ashraf al-anbiya' wal-mursaleen, habib qulubana, wa tabib nufusana, abil qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, wa ala al-bayt al-tayyibin al-tahirin, al-ma'asumin al-mukarramin. Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Inshallah, you're doing well and you're receiving this portion of the program Bridge, this session of it, in the best state of health and faith. Keep us in your du'as wherever in this world you are, as we are in need of du'as for each other, as we have been instructed by Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam. The question that we want to handle in this episode is that, can we imagine eternity? Is eternity and is the hereafter even imaginable, right? Because Imam Sajjad in the 18th dua of Sahifa Sajjadiya, which was his supplication when perils were repelled or requests quickly granted, he's saying that, O Allah, وَأَخِرْ فَقَدِّمْ لِي مَا أَخَّرْتُ وَأَخِرْ عَنِّي مَا قَدَّمْتُ. Then set before me what you have set behind, and set behind me what you have set before, pointing out to the hereafter. Why? For فَغَيْرُ كَثِيرًا مَغَبَتُهُ الْفَنَا. For that which ends in annihilation is not great, and for that which ends in subsistence is not little. وَصَلِّ عَلَى مُحَمَّدٍ وَعَلِ مُحَمَّدٍ or وَعَلِهِ. In order for us to understand the fact that there is an eternity ahead. And the question is this: how can eternity be imagined when there is no extension and no movement? Right? Everything is in the stage of standing still. Everything stops moving. That is the eternity that we are facing. Let's take a quick break and inshallah we'll return. back to this topic.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
All right, respected brothers and sisters, the question that we wanted to handle and try to possibly provide some thoughts on in accordance to the 18th dua of Sahifa Sajjadiyah is that even if we make determination and if we make the intention to start grasping and to start collecting information about the hereafter, would it be possible for us to get the ability and the power to make imagination about hereafter? Is that imaginable or it's not? Many people give up thinking about hereafter because they basically and they simply cannot imagine how hereafter would look like. Therefore, they come to the conclusion that unfortunately, which comes out of, which is not a sign of faith. In fact, it's a sign of the darkness of disbelief that there does not exist an eternity. There does not exist a hereafter, right? And they start making up belief systems and making up ideologies that they will soon figure out that they're wrong. But in here, the question that we want to handle again is how can eternity be imagined when there's no extension and no movement? This is a dead end for the scientific system that would accept everything once they're visible, once they're tangible, once you can see something. That's what the science today does, right? If you want to experiment something, if you want to make a theory or try to support your hypothesis, you need data, and data is factual, and facts are whatever that is visible to you by any means, right? And here, when it comes to the hereafter, that's where the scientific system and a mind accustomed to physical calculations stops and fails. Isn't that interesting? Where the rules of physics are not effective anymore, and the rules and scientific system will no longer be applicable. If that weapon of science is taken away from you, all of a sudden you feel so helpless. Those who have relied only on science for the being of their life. There's no water and air, but there's life. How is that possible? There's no light, but there is seeing and visibility. There's no temporal extension, but eternity is an inseparable prerequisite of that world. A destiny that is neither comprehensible nor has any parallel or equivalent. We seek refuge in the pure essence of the one God from the moment when there is no helper except Allah the Almighty. Let's take a quick break and inshallah we'll come back for a conclusion.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
Bridge.
Our respected brothers and sisters, just wanted to conclude and wrap up by saying that this final phrase or statement of the dua emphasizes the limitations of human intellect and scientific understanding when contemplating the afterlife. And it posts essential questions, fundamental questions about how one can conceive of eternity, how can one imagine the eternity without extension or movement, highlighting that the laws of physics and our accustomed scientific paradigms become irrelevant in that realm. It presents a paradox, life without water and air, right? Seeing without light, eternity without temporal extension, and paints a picture of reality utterly different from our own understanding, beyond our current comprehension. And for that, we need to keep in mind that there is a need for a true belief system to be able to set our actions and deeds in accordance to, in the life of this dunya, to be able to achieve success in that hereafter that we have been promised that there exists. Inshallah, that day of judgment will be a day of our eternal victory. Inshallah. Keep us in your du'as, and please spend time until inshallah next session contemplating on the ways that you can possibly or perhaps imagine how eternity and how hereafter looks like. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
Searching for the light, and you see no hope in sight. Be sure and have no doubt, He is always close to you. He's the one who knows you best, He knows what's in your heart. You'll find your peace at last if you just have faith in Him. You're always in my heart and mind, Your name is mentioned every day. You no matter what, my biggest wish is to see you one day. 'Cause I believe, I believe, I believe. Do you believe? Oh, do you believe?
'Cause I believe in a man who used to be so full of love and harmony. He fought for peace and liberty, and never would he hurt anything. He was a mercy for mankind, a teacher till the end of time. A creature could be compared with him, so full of light and blessings. So always in my heart and mind, mentioned every day. I'll follow you no matter what. God will to me one day. 'Cause I believe, I believe.
Every nation has its treasures. For Iran, one of the greatest is poetry. It isn't just words on paper or verses recited in classrooms. It's the heartbeat of a culture, a force that has shaped identity for more than 1,000 years. And each year on the 18th of September, Iranians pause to honor that tradition. They call it the National Day of Poetry and Literature, a day that also marks the passing of Sayyid Muhammad Hossein Behjat Tabrizi, better known as Shahryar, one of the most beloved poets of modern Iran. This week, Iran Today will look at why poetry holds such a central place in the lives of Iranians, who Shahryar was, and how the echoes of Persian verse have carried across centuries and continents, from Ferdowsi's Shahnameh to Rumi's mysticism to Shahryar's voice in the 20th century. This is a story about words that refuse to fade, and a tradition that is as alive today as it was 1,000 years ago. September 18, 1988, the day Iran lost Muhammad Hossein Behjat Tabrizi, better known for his pen name Shahryar, a poet whose verses were not only celebrated in literary circles, but embraced by ordinary people. That is why decades later, the day of his passing isn't just remembered, it's commemorated as Iran's National Day of Poetry and Literature. Born in 1906, Shahryar's childhood was shaped by the turbulence of Iran's constitutional revolution. His family fled to the countryside for safety, and it was there in a humble village school that his education began. By his teenage years, he had moved to Tehran, enrolling at the prestigious Darul Funun, and later at the School of Medicine. But it was poetry, not medicine, that captured his heart. His first collection, Divan-e-Shahryar, published in 1931, drew praise from Iran's literary giants. His verses, full of elegance and imagery, were also deeply personal, marked by the heartbreak of a forbidden love that haunted him for years. Mr. Milad Irfanpour, a rising poet and the man heading Iran's Department of Literary Creation at the country's most influential cultural institution, the artistic sect of the Islamic Republic.
What made Shahryar remarkable was first his honesty. He was deeply sincere. His poems mirrored his soul. He wore no masks, and that authenticity gave them power. That's why his verses, whether to his mother, to Imam Ali, or to a beloved one, resonate so strongly.
The loss was devastating. In 1929, Shahryar walked away from medical school, never to return. Instead, he took a series of ordinary jobs in government offices, in the Ministry of Health, and finally as an accountant at the Bank of Agriculture. Much like T.S. Eliot in the West, Shahryar lived the life of a civil servant by day and a poet by night. But poetry wasn't his only art. He was a skilled calligrapher, penning his own copy of the Holy Quran. He played music, surrounded himself with musicians, and never lost his love for the tar and sitar. In 1953, after the death of his mother, Shahryar returned to his native Tabriz. He spent the rest of his life there, writing in both Persian and Azerbaijani Turkish, cementing his reputation as the most noted figure of Persian Romanticism. His influence on modern poets was immense. We also sat down with Mr. Hossein Ali Rahimi, a member of Iran's Academy of Persian Language and Literature, and the Saadi Foundation's representative in Tajikistan.
If one modern poet deserves a national day, Shahryar is the right choice. Among the moderns, he comes closest to our classical image of the Persian poet. Others, Nima, Farooq, Akhavan, were great innovators, but Shahryar embodied tradition. He lived simply, close to the people. His ode to Imam Ali reflected not only personal faith, but the culture's fabric. His loves were human loves, his flaws, human flaws. That closeness made him relatable.
Few poets have been able to bridge the gap between the academy and the street. Shahryar was one of them. His lines became the language of the people, spoken in bazaars, repeated in homes, and even turned into proverbs. One of his most beloved verses, "You came, my soul, at your feet, but why now?" still echoes in daily conversations, proof of a poet that lived not above his people, but among them. Shahryar's gift for poetry was clear from an early age. His lyrical verses earned him the admiration of masters like Arif Ghazvini, and over the years his work fell into three broad categories: religious poems, love poems, and tributes. But the truth is, in his hands, the lines between them often blurred. What set Shahryar apart was not just what he wrote, but how he wrote. He had a musician's ear, weaving rhythm and rhyme into his verses with a precision that made them irresponsible to composers and singers. One of his love poems, "Hala Chera," Why So Late, became a classic after it was set to music by Ruhollah Khaliqi and sung by the legendary Ghulam Hussein Banan. But Shahryar was more than a romantic. He brought the ghazal, one of Persian poetry's most cherished forms, closer to everyday people. His use of colloquial language, slang, and rhythms of daily speech gave his work an intimacy and immediacy few could match. It was poetry that sounded almost like conversation, yet carried the weight of art. Over time, his work moved from love and nostalgia toward mysticism and faith. His poems in praise of Imam Ali, the first Shia Imam, became some of his most popular, recited with passion by readers across Iran. At the same time, he never abandoned his deep sense of national pride, filling his verses with imagery of Persepolis, Ferdowsi, and Iran's cultural heritage.
In general, works that endure have several features. First, they must connect with audiences linguistically. Second, their themes and values must matter to people. Third, the artistry must be of the highest level. Add to that the depth of worldview and cultural knowledge that great writers possess. Finally, when a work also carries personal passion, when it springs from the poet's own deepest attachments, it gains even more permanence. That's true of Shahryar. His devotion to Imam Ali, for instance, wasn't just theological. It was heartfelt and emotional, resonating with generations of Iranians. And of course, he was steeped in the classics. He knew Hafez and the earlier masters intimately.
And then came Heydar Babaye Salam, his masterwork in Azerbaijani Turkish. Written in 1953, it was an ode to childhood, to a mountain near his hometown of Tabriz, and to the simple joys of rural life. In its lines, Shahryar turned his mother tongue into a powerful literary language, filling it with proverbs, folklore, and memory. The poem quickly spread beyond Azerbaijan across the entire Turkic world, and today remains one of his most beloved works.
Lasting works share various traits: linguistic clarity, relevant themes, high artistry, depth of worldview, cultural knowledge, and above all, personal passion. Shahryar had all of these. His devotion to Imam Ali was not just theological, but heartfelt, resonating with generations.
In our studio, Ismail Amini, well-known poet and satirist. He spoke about Shahryar and why his fame reaches far beyond Iran's borders.
Shahryar's appeal crosses borders. In Azerbaijan, I saw streets named after him, people speaking of him as one of their own. That kind of embrace shows how great art transcends nationality. When you listen to Tchaikovsky, it does not matter whether he is Russian. His music belongs to anyone who feels its beauty. In the same way, Shahryar belongs to all who are moved by his poetry. Artists and thinkers spread beauty and wisdom across borders. Politicians, by contrast, too often spread violence and division. That is why poetry matters so deeply to us. It continues to offer connections where politics fail, and it keeps alive the cultural art we all share.
In the eyes of critics, Shahryar became one of the last guardians of classical Persian poetry, a remarkable finale to a tradition that had stretched for centuries. To his peers, he was also the face of Persian Romanticism, with verses full of lyricism, intensity, and sudden flashes of revelation. We also met Mr. Nasser Fiz, another leading poet and satirist.
Shahryar, in my opinion,
in my view, Shahryar is an important case, the representative of the last great generation of classical Persian poetry. His work carried freshness, yet he stands as the final major figure in that tradition. Remarkably, he was embraced by both Persian and Turkic-speaking audiences, reflecting his openness and lack of bias toward either language. That inclusiveness is part of his legacy.
Shahryar's poems, whether in Persian or Azerbaijani, spoke to ordinary people. They were lyrical but accessible, modern but rooted in tradition. In Shahryar, Iranians found a poet who could bridge worlds, the rural and the urban, the classical and the modern, the national and the regional.
Every great poet responds to life's questions not just in words, but in form. After the Constitutional Revolution, the question was whether classical verse would survive Nima Yushij's innovations. As you know, Nima created a new path, but Shahryar remained devoted to the Ghazal, often in dialogue with Hafez. At first, this seemed reactionary, yet Shahryar's subjects, daily life, social issues, even international politics, carried modernity within tradition. He once wrote a poetic letter to Einstein protesting the atomic bomb. Though his main forms were Ghazal and Ghasideh, one of his few modern poems is counted a masterpiece. He showed that innovation need not erase tradition. A century on, the Ghazal remains Persian poetry's strongest form.
In the summer of 1987, in the city of Tabriz, the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, sat down with one of the nation's most cherished poets. It was a rare meeting, a moment that bridged generations, during which Shahryar, the voice of Iran's modern poetic soul, recited his verses directly before him. Persian is more than a language. For centuries, it has been a thread binding together the patchwork of ethnicities and histories that make up Iran. Empires have come and gone, borders have shifted, but Persian has endured not just as a means of communication, but as a vessel of identity, carrying memory, emotion, and belonging across generations. For Mr. Amini, poetry is more than art. It's a force that unites Iranians across cultures and regions.
We are fortunate to live in a country vast in geography and rich in heritage. Iran is not a newly made state, but a civilization with a long cultural past. Even though we now hold only part of that original land, what remains is still great, and we take pride in it. Our country is large, diverse in climate, ethnicities, and languages. Amid this diversity, Persian became the common tongue. It does not belong to one group. It unites us all. And at its heart lies poetry. Prose has had many masters, but it is, generally speaking, limited to the educated. Poetry, accessible and memorable, has been embraced by everyone. That is why, no matter our background, Iranians feel kinship when a verse of Saadi or Attar is recited. Poetry has carried our cultural and intellectual identity. Where Italy has painting, Austria music, and India dance, Iran has had poetry as one of the main pillars of our unity.
Poetry across civilizations has always been more than just literature. It's philosophy set to rhythm, emotion distilled into language. It's the way humanity has expressed its highest joys and its deepest griefs. From Homer in Greece to Shakespeare in England to Tagore in India, poetry has been the vessel through which cultures preserve their wisdom, their memory, and their dreams. And in Iran, that truth has taken on a singular intensity. Here, poetry is not confined to the library or the classroom. It lives in daily speech, in proverbs passed from parent to child, in the verses recited at weddings, or whispered in moments of reflection. Few nations have produced such a continuous chain of great poets. Ferdowsi, who preserved the Persian language itself through the Shahnameh. Hafiz, whose ghazals still guide lovers and mystics alike. Sa'di, whose wisdom adorns the entrance of the United Nations. Rumi, whose verses cross spiritual and linguistic borders. Omar Khayyam, whose quatrains wrestle with fate and the fleeting nature of life.
Persian poetry also matters abroad because it carries distilled wisdom, reflections on life and death, love and loss, justice and oppression, mortality and eternity. Our greatest poets were also sages, which is why many bore the title Hakim, Ferdowsi, Nizami, Khayyam, Nasir Khusro. Some were scientists or philosophers too, but all engaged great human questions in ways intelligible beyond our culture. That universality is Persian literature's genius.
This isn't history frozen in museums. In Iran, these poets are alive in conversation. Their words are coded in political speeches, sung in music, and inscribed on the walls of homes and gardens. Poetry has been Iran's conscience, its refuge, and its mirror. Persian is also the second language of the Islamic world and the cornerstone of Iranian civilization. From philosophy to mysticism, from history to art, it has left a footprint that extends far beyond Iran's borders. Even in distant lands, this language, lyrical, resilient, and profoundly human, continues to resonate.
In Iran, poetry is our foremost art. Why? Because we reached its highest peaks. Hafez, Sa'di, Rumi, Khayyam, giants translated worldwide, alive for centuries. Through poetry, Iran's culture and knowledge.